city of Texas.
Welcome to the Edible Community Show in the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains. And if you're a frequent listener, you know that I share this seat with my colleagues, Kate Manchester, the publisher of Edible Santa Fe, and Marla Camp, the publisher of Edible Austin. Every Monday, thanks to our sponsor, today we're excited to have Saxelby Cheesemongers as our sponsor. And I just want to point out that Ann Saxelby has done so much for our Vermont farmers and the artisanal cheese movement here. So I envy all of you folks who get to visit her on a frequent basis because she is really the best in the biz. But thanks to her, we get to bring you community-based, locally oriented stories about the farmers, growers, chefs, community members, and food artisans that create the distinct culinary regions we all enjoy throughout the U.S. and Canada. And every season, we're doing the same through the pages of Edible Communities publications. You can check us out on our website at ediblecommunities.com. So, our show today. If you're in the mood to travel and you're anticipating that first taste of fall, you've tuned in to the right program. Our topic today is about one of the most popular segments of the travel industry, culinary tourism. My guess is that almost everyone listening to our program has made at least one vacation decision based on where or what they're going to eat. A unique food and drink experience has been shown to be as popular a travel incentive as exhibits, museums, recreation, or shopping. Defined as travel to learn about or enjoy unique and memorable eating and drinking experiences, culinary tourism is an important aspect of most visitors' time in Vermont. And why wouldn't it be? We have more cheesemakers, artisan bakers, and brewers per capita than most states. We have more farmers markets than the closest producer-to-consumer relationship of any state. And recent research indicates that almost 50% of leisure travelers now feel that the opportunity to try different and unusual cuisines is a very or extremely desirable attribute of a vacation. So I have a feeling I'm speaking to all of you who are listening. Not surprisingly, Vermont's an ideal place to experience food in the context of culture. We're going to talk a lot about that today. My two guests are both involved in creating experiences and events that bring people and food together. Chris Howells, the founder of Vermont Farm Tours, after graduating from Middlebury College and starting a vineyard and small farm with his father, Chris had the good fortune to attend a Terra Madre in 2006 and 2008. Many lives have been transformed after participating in this unique and powerful gathering of farmers, growers, and producers from around the world, convened by Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food. Chris's was one of them. He says that his aha moment happened when at the gathering in 2006, he heard Carlo Petrini say to the thousands of farmers in attendance, "Your story, the one we can taste, touch, smell, and see, is the one most valuable and one of the most valuable assets to humankind." At that moment, Chris knew that sharing the story of Vermont's food producers would be his calling. Now, Nick Cowles, who we're going to talk about as well, he represents the type of producer Chris likes to showcase in his tours. He's the owner of Shelburne Orchards. He and his family have been tending to the same picturesque orchard for three generations. They have 80 acres of apple trees, of which 10 are organic, and they're located on the shores of Lake Champlain in Shelburne, Vermont. Quick to let you know that he couldn't do it all himself, Nick manages the orchard and its store and festivals with a great team of people. One of them, Megan Humphrey, is joining us today, and she'll be telling us about a small farms festival the orchard is hosting in just a few weeks, as well as sharing her thoughts about consumers and travelers' growing interest in knowing where their food is from. So let's take a short break, and we'll be back with Chris and Megan. Hi, welcome back. Welcome back to the Edible Community Show on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro. I want to thank our sponsor, Saxilby Cheesemongers, for making today's broadcast possible. And if you're just joining us, our topic today is culinary tourism, and we're speaking with Chris Howell, founder of Vermont Farm Tours, and Megan Humphrey from Shelburne Orchards. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thank you.
Great to have you here. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
You too.
So I'm going to put this into context for our listeners. Let's consider that over 40% of Vermont's economy comes from visitors to our state. Over $200 million in tax revenue comes from the money they spend. 60,000 Vermonters work in the industry in one capacity or another. And I'm thinking it's probably more because people working on farms and as food producers probably aren't considered in that hospitality total. So it's a big industry with an important impact, and it seems more so than ever. So, Chris, you've developed a business that started with that aha moment, a way to get people connecting to the food in Vermont, and you've called it Vermont Farm Tours. Share with us a little bit about what sort of brought you to this beyond that aha moment and how you went about deciding who you wanted to introduce people to and showcase in the state.
Sure. So the basic concept behind Vermont Farm Tours is to connect guests from a variety of backgrounds to taste, place, and producer, and kind of see the magical connections that exist there. I bring guests to meet, eat with, and learn from, a lot of people in Vermont changing how we engage food. You know, there's something tremendously powerful about eating real food with the person who made it on the very soil it comes from. Vermont Farm Tours appeals to a broad audience, anyone from locals who want to connect with farmers to, a vacationer from Jersey. And, what I try to get across is I want to leave them with a rich story in their mind and the urge to seek out similar experiences close to home. Ultimately, I hope to inspire connections between producers and consumers, or co-producers, as Slow Food calls them, that will strengthen and help to build a regional food system.
So I know you were on a tour just before joining us today, mm-hmm. and why don't you really give us the experience? Tell us a little bit about what that might have been like if
okay.
we had been there with
yeah.
you.
So the tour I just came from, called the Incredible Edible Intervale, showcases some of the farmers and organizations that contribute to a phenomenon in urban agriculture known as the Intervale. The Intervale is a 350-acre piece of land to the north of Burlington, within city limits, that hosts 12 independent organic farmers and a number of organizations. It's all knitted together by the Intervale Center in a nonprofit organization that works with beginning farmers to help them develop a solid business plan and learn how to, market and, become a viable business. It also works with a number of other ventures to help fund, this whole program.
And how long has the Intervale been there? How long have people been farming at the Intervale?
So the Intervale itself, has been farmed by the Abenaki, for hundreds of years. And, it has historically been a farming center in Burlington. In the last 100 or so years, it was a dairy. And then it in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, it's kind of fallen into disrepair and is, it became a junk heap and a pretty unsafe to go in Burlington. It was the other side of the tracks, literally. And Bernie Sanders, then mayor of Burlington, worked with Will Rapp, who founded Gardner Supply Company, to create the Intervale Center and turn it into a farm incubator. So, from, Abenaki land to, historical farming center to junk heap to thriving farm incubator, it's a pretty vivid
impressive history.
Yeah.
Well, it's also in the floodplain right along the river there, too, which is what makes it a great place to grow crops.
Yeah, it's bottomland soil, the best in Burlington.
Yeah.
So just to give you a picture of what the tour looks like, we'll meet Glenn, the executive director of Intervale Center, and he kind of gives us an overview of the history of the place and all the different programs that Intervale Center is working on currently. and then we'll walk through Intervale Community Farm, which is, you know, I think it's the oldest CSA community-supported agriculture in the state of Vermont, and definitely the largest. There's 500 members. My roommate is actually picking up our CSA share right now as I speak.
Well, and I might want to, let's take a minute and just define CSA. I think those of us living in this type of community take it for granted, but I'll mention that I'm picking up my CSA to folks who may not live around here. And a CSA share, it stands for Community Supported Agriculture, as Chris mentioned, and essentially you pay the farmer in advance of the season so that they have the funds they need to be able to do their farming. And I believe that our CSA program in Vermont has grown at least, 50-60% each year. It's just amazing. So you were telling that that's one of the first community farms to do that, Intervale Community Farm.
And so we'll walk through the Intervale and meet some of the farmers. And I think the real magic on the tour happens when the farmer is able to kind of tell their story and, you know, describe the roots they have to the land. And it's a pretty memorable and engaging story when you're able to talk about, you know, what you grow and why you grow it and who eats it, and be able to describe a relationship that, you know, it's unique to Burlington and to Vermont. And
some of the challenges of farming.
Yeah, you know, it's not
people might not think about when they're in the grocery store. But
was there a story today that was particularly?
We walked past Intervale Compost, and Jess Sankey, the Chittenden County Solid Waste District Education and Outreach Coordinator, kind of told us the compost story. And there's one that could be a little bit off or
distasteful,
to say the least. And she turned it into a pretty interesting discussion about, you know, waste stream and turning our region's waste into a, you know, product that is economically beneficial to our area, and it supports healthy soils in the Intervale. So, you know, she definitely sold four non-composters on composting, and then they went over to Gardner Supply and got all the stuff they needed to get their own compost going.
So what's really going on is this wonderful commerce that you're creating down there. But what did she say that made them decide they needed a compost? Is there one thing in particular?
I think it was the idea that you can turn waste into a resource. And, you know, theoretically, that's a pretty engaging thing. And then when you can take a handful of this stuff that we saw a truck, you know, dump sludge, you know, gross stuff, and she, you know, took us around and, you know, took a handful of the finished product, and there's some black gold that will make your flowers grow, your vegetables taste better, and it doesn't smell. And it, you know, as a matter of fact, it's completely safe to put your hands in, and then real benefit for your garden. So
a very powerful illustration of what could happen. Mm-hmm.
And it's fairly easy to do around here. I mean, most of us have a yard or some little corner. It takes very little space to be able to compost. So, and then it's transferring it and getting it down there. So it's pretty easy to do.
And it's interesting what we're exporting, you know, so we, you know, and we talk about this idea of tourism, and it'd be interesting to see, Chris, if you could do the compost tour one day. You could actually get people to come on a waste tour, but it's an excellent byproduct of what you're trying to do.
Sure.
Who else did you visit?
So we went to Half Pint Farm. Mara and Spencer Welton are two local rock stars, you know, work a lot with slow food and produce some of the most beautiful and delicious produce that I know of.
And interesting.
Yes.
All the different colored carrots.
Great. Fantastic.
And another fascinating thing I find, we could tell people that they're visiting a piece of Rome when they come to Vermont and go to the Intervale, because Spencer has designed his farm, has he not, to be exactly the size, because he has a degree, some sort of advanced degree in ancient history of some sort. And he designed the farm to be exactly as it would have been in Roman times, because he felt that was a way to appease his father for not using his college education.
That's great.
Now he's a farmer, so you might be able to add that on one of your tours.
Yeah, interesting.
If you didn't know that about them. So So what are I'm sort of curious about people's reactions to how this might exist where they're from. I mean, Pennsylvania, you said you had folks here from Pennsylvania, lots of farmland in Pennsylvania, all the Amish country, and have they had any familiarity with that?
Yeah, and one of the reasons they were coming is because they were involved in the urban agricultural scene in Philadelphia, and they wanted a look at how it was going on in Burlington, Vermont. And so they were, you know, they were already on the bandwagon, so to speak, and, you know, hopefully we'll stay connected with Intervale and create a bit of, you know, shared knowledge between Intervale Center and the stuff going on in Philly.
And what other types of tours? You do a lot of tours, so mm-hmm. that's the Incredible Edible Intervale Tour. You have a Savor Burlington Tour.
So, yeah, I'll just quickly go through.
Yeah, I'd like to give people an idea of what a Vermont farm, because I think for some people Vermont farm tour might mean we bring you here and you milk a cow, which will actually, that's actually more about, well, and that's also agritourism, I'm told, right? Mm-hmm. There's a distinction between culinary tourism and agritourism, but culinary tourism is a little bit more about the taste of places we like to mm-hmm. talk about, mm-hmm. and I know you do that with a lot of your tours. So take us through the list. You've got the Savor Burlington.
So Savor Burlington is a walking culinary tour of downtown Burlington, and the superstar behind that tour is the farmers market and going around and tasting and meeting a lot of the different vendors and farmers there. Vermont farmers markets are an ideal way to maintain a healthy and vibrant connection with the people producing your food. And so this is kind of the gateway to that. Then we do, you know, beer tasting and chocolate. So it's
a perfect day.
It's a yummy day. So that's Savor Burlington. And then the Vermont Farm Tour starts at Shelburne Farms and kind of learn about the history of a big, huge, homestead turned into an educational center, and then move on to another couple of farms like Shelburne Orchards. And, that one is a lot, more for kids and families where you want a kind of a diverse experience of the, wonderful people and agriculture happening in the area. Vermont Vineyards is a wine tour, and that's something pretty close to my heart. I started getting into wine in college, working at Lincoln Peak Vineyard, and ended up buying rootstock from Chris Granstrom, who owns Lincoln Peak, and starting my own small operation compared to that. And so I just love taking people to visit some of the vineyards here. Something really awesome about Vermont Vineyards is that the wine that is being produced here showcases the varietals, the Northern Hardy varietals, which you wouldn't be able to pick up in your average supermarket. And so there's some other, there's very interesting tastes that are, very well done by the vintners here in Vermont.
And I think a lot of people are surprised to know that we have a really growing Vermont wine industry.
There are a lot of them
growing
now.
Growing good wine.
Yeah,
you know?
Good wine, yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually something you can drink. We'll have to do a show on that in the future. just wine.
Yeah, we can do a taste test
while we're on air.
Then there's the Incredible Edible Intervale, which I just talked about, and Brewing Up Vermont, which is a brew tour where we get to meet some real characters, brewers, and kind of go behind the scenes and just see how small-scale beer is made and eat good food along the way, too. So it's kind of like a gastronomic brew tour. And that one's fun because the people who brew beer love beer, and they love talking about beer. So it's a real fun thing.
Do you have any good anecdotes or stories from recent brew tours that you can share?
Yeah, well, here's a quick one. So Mark down at Bobcat Cafe in Bristol, he used to be the master brewer at Otter Creek Brewing, which, I'm sure many people are familiar with. And he is now the brewer at this restaurant, Bobcat Cafe. And so he's tremendously experienced and expert brewer. And so the brewery in Bobcat is located kind of in the depths of this restaurant. So you go down this narrow staircase, and here's Mark, talking way over your head with brewing terms and telling you about all this, you know, crazy stuff that he's trying out. And you get down there, and there's, you know, the kettles and, you know, the malts. And the first thing he does, you know, when I was there last week, was he goes into the freezer and opens up. He's like, guess what I got? I have local hops from Lincoln, which is, you know, just over the hill from Bristol.
Right.
And he pulls out this handful of frozen hops, you know, whole hops, and, you know, has everyone smell them. And then he goes over to the malts and says, this is this new malt I'm trying out. And we were able to, like, taste it and chew on it. And it's just a, you know, a pretty lucky experience to be able to munch and chew and get to talk with the person that is making the beer. And not only that, someone who's so enthusiastic and knowledgeable. Mm-hmm.
Well, and generally, if you go on a vineyard tour, you might taste a grape.
Mm-hmm.
That's not uncommon, but to go on a brewer tour, you don't often get to taste the hops from malt. But that's very exciting that we have some local hops growing now.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's going to be one of the next big things in local microbreweries, is the hop production is starting to actually take off, and there's people that are doing it, you know, commercially now, and it's going to grow.
And you heard it here first on the Heritage Radio Network. That's the future.
Lincoln hops from Vermont.
So you've also got a cheese tour, which is, of course, an important thing to have in Vermont. How do you choose where to go in Vermont on a cheese tour when we have, I think we have now, what, 40-plus artisanal cheese producers in our state?
Yeah. It's the highest per capita in the country.
Yeah.
Artisan cheese production. So.
And dairy fat is good. There's new research now that dairy fat is good.
I'm relieved.
Yes.
Not only good for you, but it makes you so happy when you eat it, especially when you're eating it on the farm.
And so where have you taken some folks on a
cheese tour? On the cheese tour, we go to Champlain Valley Creamery. Shelburne Farms is where we start out again and see mm-hmm. their cheese-making operation, visit Nat Bacon, their cheese-making manager. And Champlain Valley Creamery and then Dancing Cow Farm. And Jamie at Champlain Valley Creamery is a wonderful character and just a big guy that is fantastic storyteller. And from there we go to Dancing Cow Farm, where Karen and Steve are two exceptionally kind people that absolutely love what they're doing, love where they are, and have the happiest cows I've ever met.
How do you tell a cow is happy?
She'll usually come over and get scratched behind the ears and just has this very mellow, contented look in her eyes.
Well, mm-hmm. their name's Dancing Cow, so that must be one of the hints, yep.
Yeah, when they turn out the spring cow as they go off and dance in the fields and pick up their heels, that's where the name comes from. Yeah.
They're so happy to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, one of the other very key things in Vermont, food-wise, is our
maple production. So maple is something that my family has been sugaring for a long time, and it's just something that I think is one of those things that's in my blood, and I can feel it in my bones when the dirt roads start thawing, and you can start feeling things percolating and growing a little bit, and the sap's flowing, and you just. When the sap runs, you can just feel it. And to be able to, bring people and have them feel that experience at a farm where they're, doing it wood-fired, collecting sap with horses, it's just a tremendous experience. And, it's one of those things where you can, not only taste the connection between people and place, but you can also feel it. And it's a really powerful thing, sugaring.
Well, and I'm not sure our listeners will know this, but there is a Friendly's restaurant in Vermont, and they are the only Friendly's that serves real maple syrup. And apparently they started wanting to charge for that, but there was such an outcry that they're not able to do that now. And we actually had a story in Edible Green Mountains about maple, and the author was living in New Jersey, but she sugared. She grew up here in Vermont, and her stories began with her telling how she had to go to a place in New Jersey and pay for syrup with her pancakes if she wanted real maple syrup. So we can guarantee people if they come visit us, they won't have to put fake syrup on their pancakes. So now that you're very hungry and have all these great ideas of food in your mind, why don't we take a short break? And when we come back, we'll talk more to Megan about the orchard and what we can look forward to in the fall. back. This is the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to the Edible Community Show. And I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro. I want to thank our sponsors, Saxelby Cheese, for making today's program possible. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking about culinary tourism. We're really speaking about food more than anything. And we're talking to Chris Howell from Vermont Farm Tours and Megan Humphrey from Shelburne Orchards. So, Megan, I think it would be very inconsiderate of us not to share with our listeners where you can get the best apple cider donuts in the state, mm-hmm. maybe in the country, and that is the orchard where you work. So tell us a little bit about how that tradition got started, and then we'll go back to the apples.
Okay. We've been making cider donuts there for a long time, and people come to the orchard for a number of different reasons, but honestly, some of them just come for the cider donuts. So they'll show up and they'll get their dozen and promise they'll share them and then head off again. So it's a lot of fun.
And I don't know, I grew up in the Midwest. I don't think I ever had a cider donut until I moved to Vermont. And there's something, I think it's part of that sugary stuff you put on the outside or something. They're very different.
Dipped in cinnamon sugar at the very end. You can also get them plain, but most people want the cinnamon sugar on them, and they're delicious. And I'm not a big donut fan, but there is something, and it's the smell in the air in the autumn yeah. of the donuts cooking, and it could be a bad habit.
Well, I read that Nick, the owner and founder of the orchard, said that he has backup machines because if one of
right.
them runs out, there would be an actual riot.
Right. I mean, and it's more and more difficult to find those machines. They're older machines. So he also buys parts machines. So he swears we're going to end up with a museum sometime of all these old donut makers. They're called donut robots. So
donut
people have
robots.
To tend to them, but you put the dough into them and it goes through this little treadmill and goes through all the process of making the donut, so to come out that perfectly golden brown.
Well, it's well worth a visit. For any of our listeners who want a great time to come to Vermont, I would say any time after Labor Day
donuts? Yes, after Labor Day we'll start donuts. We haven't started pressing cider yet because it's still pretty tart. We opened this weekend, so a couple of days ago it opened. And some people come early in the season. They love their really tart right at the beginning, which are actually my favorite. And once we have some frosty nights, the apples get a little bit sweeter. But
so. Well, I wanted you to tell us a little. There's so much that goes on at your orchard. So you had told me, and I thought it was so interesting, that people are picking more of their own apples, you're finding.
Yes.
And I think that ties a little into this culinary tourism concept. On a break, we were talking a little bit about how you can be a culinary tourist where you live. You don't have
right.
to travel somewhere. Tell us a little bit about what you're noticing with the community and how that's happening.
There's definitely been a much bigger shift. We used to pick more apples and deliver them to the local co-ops or farmers markets. And there's been a really big shift in more recent years of more of the percentage of the way apples are taken from the orchard is that people are coming and picking them themselves. So it really is a whole event, and whether it's a group of college kids who want to come to the orchard and do that as a fall event or a family. My cousins were here from Scotland a couple of years ago, and they just loved that we could go to the orchard and pick some apples right there. So it really is it's just a really nice way to spend an afternoon.
And I've noticed that Nick has such a commitment to the community. I mean, he's really created the farm as a place where, beyond the apples, people really want to go. And I wondered a little bit about how that all evolved for him, how it developed, and a little bit since he's the third generation. Well, he's the second generation.
Right.
His kids are the third.
Right.
Share with us a little bit of the history of the place and how some of that came together.
I think to me it seems as though it's sort of part of what's happening in Vermont in general, that people are very, very aware here, much more than other places in the country, of where their food comes from. So it's not that much of a leap to get people to come to the farm and have an experience there and get to know the farmer. Nick is also quite a character, so that adds to it. He's a lot of fun. He's a great storyteller. He's very interesting. He's sort of a Renaissance man. He's an artist and he's a musician, so there are lots of different aspects of his life. But he does. He gives a lot back to the community, and I also think that's part of it is making sure that the community is involved in a lot of different ways. So the festivals that he plans or that we all plan as a team there tie into that as well.
Well, and tell us a little more about the annual Small Farms Food Fest, because in some of the research I've done about culinary tourism, a lot of it is designed around these types of festivals. And Chris, I would think that in the future you'll probably be designing some tours that'll have a festival as an anchor. We just had our Vermont first annual Cheesemakers Festival. I could certainly see that becoming. We had so many people come from out of state for that. So tell us a little about this, because I've lived here 5 years, and I remember it 3 years ago, and now it's grown so much.
Yeah,
so
it's grown a lot. It started, I wasn't originally involved with it, but over the last few years I've become more involved. It started with probably a few hundred people, and the first year was right after 9/11, so it was very interesting. It happened the weekend after that, so people were sort of subdued and more thoughtful about it, and since then it's become a much larger festival. We've gone from a few hundred to a few thousand every year who are in attendance, and we don't want to lose the original feel of it so much, but we have about 30 food vendors. It's farmers and food producers from different areas in Vermont. People even come up as from the southern part of the state to be involved with the festival.
You might want to share some of, because what I think is interesting, it's not all completely specific apple-related things.
Right. It's a pretty good cross-section of their meat producers and vegetable farmers. Finding cheese producers has been very difficult, which is very interesting.
So for all our listeners out there who are cheese producers in Vermont, you might want to join us.
We have two cheese producers, but that's it. At this point, we have Taylor Farm, and they're from the southern part of the state, and Shelburne Farms. But cheese producers, it's a good problem for them, and makes it a difficult problem for us. The demand is so high for their cheese that they don't need the publicity or can't manufacture enough to add another festival to what they're doing. So it's great for them.
That is good news.
Yeah. We have all kinds of, somebody does granola. We have a pretty good cross-section, maple syrup. So it's definitely not just apple-related, but it's farm and food producers here.
And you can buy the product there?
Yes. And it's different from a farmer's market because people can't just come and sell their vegetables. So they need to make a dish out of those vegetables and then sell that.
Oh, and why is that? That's interesting.
It's to make it a little different than the farmers markets. Most of the farmers markets are on Saturdays, and this is on a Sunday, so folks can go to farmers markets and buy their vegetables. But this is really a chance to come and try something different. It may be something that consumers hadn't thought of in terms of putting different foods together.
So you're really creating a marketing opportunity for folks
right.
so that they can
Absolutely.
Educate consumers about
right.
some other ways.
And we tend towards smaller farms so that we can really help promote them as well. So they're the ones that may need the publicity a little bit more, the extra push. And again, people get to meet the farmers and the food producers directly, ask them questions, find out a lot more about the product.
Well, and it's also the entertainment. You mentioned Nick is a musician.
Right.
So the entertainment is legendary.
Yeah, we have live music all day. We have a lot of other sort of family-friendly activities. We have tractor hay rides, and you can watch cider being pressed. There are lots of other face painting for the kids. There are lots of other things. And then you can go, the way that the fee works is that if you're under 12 years old or over 65, you get in for free. And if you're over 12 and under 65, you need to pay a $5 admission fee, but in return for that, you get a $5 pick-your-own coupon. So a lot of folks get the coupon and turn around and go back out into the orchard and pick apples that day, as well as all the other events that are happening.
And there's also a store where you sell
right.
a lot of local products.
Right. We have a lot of Vermont products. We're trying more and more to get them to be Vermont products, and we have all kinds of things that are made in Vermont, some wooden toys for kids. We have a woman who's doing beautiful aprons and kids' aprons that are adorable. They have little cooking utensils in the pockets, so there are lots more and more of them, local greeting cards. So,
which you design?
Some of them, yes. Yeah.
What percentage of people coming to the Orchard now would you say are from out of state, or even who are truly doing it as a, not this is around the corner, I can go get my weekly apples here, but this is
right.
a destination opportunity?
I don't know what the percentage is, but I'm always surprised because when I'm there, I often ask people where they're visiting from, and it's interesting because people are very local, so it's just adjoining towns, but it's also from all over the country and the world. It's very interesting how much further people are traveling for something like that.
Well, and I had asked you, you know, we all have seen some of the folks out there who ship fruits from all over the planet.
Right.
And I had asked you about whether or not people could, because if they come on a tour and they fall in love with your apples, what are they supposed to do? And I guess you have one day of the year?
Right. We have one day that we ship. It's sort of in the middle of the season, and we ship anywhere in the U.S. So people can get, and we... It's a little bit difficult, but we have about 20 different kinds of apples, varieties of apples that are grown there, but we just ship Macintosh apples, which frankly are my favorite anyways.
Okay.
But and then you can add Shelburne Farms cheese to that or not, but those are the two options. But and you can also just take them home and ship them yourself, too. People who live locally often do that.
And do you think there's something that makes the Vermont apple distinctive from what you've heard?
Well, I think so, but I don't know if people from around the country, I don't want to, you know, there are great apple orchards in New York, too, and Washington State, there are wonderful apples from all over the place. But I love the fact that you can go to the orchard and pick any of these varieties. People are demanding more varieties. They're asking for more.
And
that influences the orchard, for sure.
And the varieties they're asking for, what's motivating that? Is there that much difference in taste? Is it they're looking for... a particular recipe, and it called, you know, an ancient recipe
right.
called for something.
Right. I think it's all of those. I think that because it's sort of a global market now, you can get apples from Japan, you can get them from all over the world now, and once people taste them from another place or another country, they may think, oh, that would be kind of fun to have it here. So I think that may have affected it somewhat.
Well, Chris, you would be able to tell us a little bit about this terroir connection.
Yeah.
How do you think that works for people when they're tasting these apples? And what are some apples that would be specific for us here? We're hearing about all these different varieties coming,
right.
but are there actual apples that are more appropriate for Vermont?
Just to define terroir first.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a good idea.
The quick and dirty terroir is, you know, the taste of the land. And I would, you know, broaden that to be the taste of place. And place being the people that are there, you know, the way it's made and the tradition and you know, personalities behind the food too affect its flavor. You know, meeting Nick at meeting Megan and mm-hmm. having an apple with them is going to change how it tastes. And, you know, a good example of this is we're having beer with Paul, who runs American Flatbread, who is the, you know, the brewer there. And, you know, we were trying to figure out, you know, our tasting got a little mixed up, and we were trying to figure out, you know, which beer was which. And, you know, we were tasting blueberries in this one beer that had, you know, blueberries in it. And, you know, that was just by, you know, by power of, you know, assumption that we tasted blueberries in there. And then, you know, Paul came and he switched the beers around. He said, no, this beer has no blueberries in it. You're not tasting that. And then he, you know, told us a little bit about the beers. And as he kind of narrated their story, those flavors, you know, started speaking to us. And, you know, I think the power of suggestion is pretty important in terroir, too. You know, I would say terroir is also, you know, what you bring as an mm-hmm. eater to the food. And so when you're talking about local apples, you know, there's a tremendous number of even new varieties now that are really different tastes. And those tastes are only made richer when you're able to go to the place it's from and meet the people making them.
Well, and I'm thinking too about in some ways, why are we so surprised that culinary tourism is a big and popular way of travel? I mean, when you travel, you tend to be a little more relaxed, a little
right.
less rushed. You're thinking a little bit more about the experience you're having. You hopefully like the people you're having it with. And so, as you said, you bring all of these different things in. And I was recently talking to another food producer who was talking about how much the visual cues affect the flavor of something. So if you're making something with an orange flavor, like a chocolate, for example, mm-hmm. you might want to garnish it with a little bit of orange peel to prepare the taster for the fact that there might be some citrus. So there's a lot of these little connections that go on with all of these parts.
And I like the idea that you're connecting with the people as well, because it's often a memory, so that seniors come back to the orchard, you know, older people come back to the orchard, and they have very distinct memories of putting food by when they were younger, or the smell of apple pies, or what applesauce would smell like in their kitchen or something like that. And I was, when Chris was talking, I was thinking about, I remember so vividly when I was really little in the fall, and you'd have an apple, and I grew up on a farm that was separate from the dairy part of it, but we lived in the farmhouse and on all this acreage and everything in the country, and we would eat apples outside, and I can remember the feeling of the juice running down my hands and how my hands were cold because it was the fall, mm-hmm. but it was that eating the apple outside, you know, and I hadn't really thought about that, but that certainly is, you know, we all bring food memory to the experience too.
And do you find people talk about memories on your tours?
Yeah, I think one of the most, you know, magical experiences on a tour is when there's a family, and I've had a tour where there's a grandparent, a parent, and, you know, an 8-year-old kid, and to get the whole family talking about those food memories, and, you know, it's, you know, on the one hand beautiful, on the other hand a little sad that they don't, you know, it's not our tradition to communicate those stories, and so sometimes it's the first time that this parent has heard, you know, their dad talk about, you know, these food memories and food traditions. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, it's nice to have this space to share those experiences, because, you know, maybe they're recipes, and, you know, maybe they're memories, but, you know, most of all they're, you know, family, and they speak to the connection among people, and you know, just seeing that happen, I think it brings family a little bit closer together when you're able to share those food traditions.
There's a wonderful saying in a restaurant that I used to go to when I lived in St. Louis that said, "Water divides the world, wine unites it." And I think that's sort of the case for food. So I think we'll just take a short break. When we come back, I want to remember to talk about iPods and apple pie, and we'll talk about what those things have in common. Thanks. The Edible Community Show. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, and I want to thank our sponsors, Saxelby Cheese. Ann Saxelby is a great friend of Vermont artisan cheesemakers, and she was just here for our big festival, and today we've been talking about culinary tourism, and of course visiting our cheesemakers is a big part of that. We have Chris with us, who's from Vermont Farm Tours, and Megan, who's with us from Shelburne Orchards. So I said when we come back, I wanted to talk about iPods and apple pie, and what those things might have in common. And also want to give both of our guests a chance to tell us about some fun food memories. So we'll get to that, too, before we have to go. But, Megan, tell us a little bit about this Apples to iPods program, which I understand goes on not only in Vermont, or is it only a Vermont event?
I'm not sure if it's – I know it's at least in this state. And
I know it's
know
statewide,
if it's,
right. Yeah.
Small Dog Electronics is one of the sponsors, and the state is a sponsor. And it doesn't just happen at Shelburne Orchards, but it's at different orchards all around the state, orchards who have agreed to participate. And there's a wooden apple that's hidden somewhere in the orchard. I honestly don't have any idea where it is at Shelburne Orchards. Nick goes out and tries to hide it really, really, really well. And if you find the wooden apple, you can call the number on the wooden apple, and you get an iPod in return for it. So it's a great reason
to
go to the orchard. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and a great way to – so there's one day of the season they do that, or how long
does it – It's during the season.
Okay, so they kick it off, I think, Tuesday, September 15th.
Right, and they've also opened that to make the kickoff a public event this year, so that will really be fun. Woodchuck Cider is going to have a taste testing there, and we'll have Shelburne Farms cheese, hopefully some other cheese as well. We'll have those famous cider donuts, and hopefully we'll have cider by then. And
so we have to hope people don't find the apple the first night, right?
Right.
Because that might...
And it has happened also that within a couple of hours, Nick will come back and, you know, someone's found it. They must be thinking like him because he's very, very careful about it. I think he goes on out under the cloak of darkness
and hides it.
I know.
Well, and one other thing we definitely have to talk about, I guess there's a whole tradition. Everybody's family probably has their recipe for apple pie.
Right.
And I want to just make a point to Chris that I think one of the great culinary tourism experiences should include the chance to do some baking or some actual hands-on cooking.
Oh, absolutely.
And we can talk about that in a minute, and maybe you could even get us together with Nick, who I'm told makes the most legendary apple pie.
He's a great pie baker, and in terms of my family, I'm not a pie baker. I make great bread, but I'm not a pie baker. My dad was a pie baker in my family, so it's really sweet to have met Nick years ago, and he's the pie baker in that family, and he's a great pie baker, and his recipe is on the orchard bag that you can take home with you when you leave, with filled with apples. But his is very complicated, and you take the pie out while it's halfway through the baking process, and you add some egg white and butter and sugar again and put it back in. And he uses this big marble pie crust roller and everything, so it's very involved.
Now, is there a crust on the top?
Yes, it's a double-crusted apple
and
pie.
And how do you add something if there's already a crust on the top?
It just goes on the top of it. It gets brushed onto the top
of
it.
On the top,
yes.
Okay.
So,
well, we'll have to go make sure we try. Or maybe we can put Chris together with Nick.
That would
and
be great.
Have that be one of the great events that you pay a premium for to be able
and
to.
And Nick does some pie baking classes too
at the
orchard.
He's done
that. Yep, he does it at the orchard.
That's
and
great.
Then we have a pie fest every year as well. So we have 30 different entrants that submit their double crusted apple pie and see if they can come up as the winner.
And who has won in the past?
It's a number of different people win every year. I'm amazed at how many people enter year after year after year, even after
they've
won.
Oh.
And it's very interesting. It's a good cross-section. And we have little kids entering up to seniors who enter. It's quite the cross-section, men and women.
Do you have to be a resident? Or speaking of culinary tourism, can you travel here to enter?
I think you can travel here to enter as long as you pre-register. That's the big thing because it gets filled up pretty quickly. And we can't do more than 30 pies. It's a lot for judges to taste.
And who are the judges?
This year we have Emily Betts from Bistro Sauce in Shelburne. And I'm trying to remember the other. I'm going to have to come back to that.
No problem.
I'm having the brain freeze.
What do you think has what would make the award-winning pie if we wanted to give someone a little?
It varies a lot. It depends on the judges. It's
uh-huh.
really different. It's very personal, and each judge comes to it from a different place. We've got the food writer at 7 Days is coming.
Suzanne's
coming.
Yeah.
So it depends on what their taste buds are. And then we have the a gentleman, Arthur, who has his own line
of Arthur's
sauces
fault,
and
right?
marinades. So if it's Arthur's fault. So, and that's what also makes it different and interesting is that it's different judges every year. So it's not necessarily the same pie that would win every year.
You have some very sophisticated palates on that panel this year.
I know,
I'd be
true.
Pretty nervous, too.
And we have pie bakers, and they'll make many pies, 20 pies, and then do taste testings before and during the season, and it's very interesting.
And all your apples? Do they have to be made?
They don't have to be made from our apples. Most people do come and pick our apples or buy them at the store at the Cider House Farm Market that we have there, but they don't have to be from there.
Hmm.
But it has to be double-crusted, and it has to be apple and fruit only, so people can't add lots
chocolate.
Of other things. We're really trying to keep it traditional, pretty traditional apple pie.
Well, one day you'll have to do a little cookbook with
yes,
all of those apple pie
right.
recipes.
We've done a little recipe packet with some of them, and some people don't love to share their recipe because it's their secret.
That's true.
People put vinegar in the crust, and we had a International Food Network show last year, The Glutton for Punishment, Bob Bloomer, and he ended up adding just a tiny bit of bacon fat to the pie crust because lard typically
right.
and traditionally has made the pie crust really flaky, and he came in, he did really well. It's a blind taste test, so nobody knew it was his pie, but the judges loved it. And then we eat all the pies afterwards. So it's really fun. Everybody sits down. Yeah. Chris wants to be there. Chris will bring his own fork. But it's a lot of fun because then we get to eat all the pies.
Well, I think that sounds like something worth traveling for. And maybe that's another idea. Chris could build an apple tour. Mm-hmm. Could have a seasonal apple tour.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be nice to hear from each of you about some of your travel memories. Because we're talking, you know, Chris sort of brought up this whole notion of the comprehensive nature of a travel experience. So why don't we start with you, Chris, about what's a memory you have that you might want to share with us that kind of ties into this whole notion of connecting with your food?
Hmm. You mentioned at the beginning, you know, traveling to eat or you know, having what you eat guide where you go.
Mm-hmm.
And That reminded me of, you know, traveling with a couple farmers after Terra Madre in 2008. And I hadn't ever traveled with people that, you know, our purpose in everywhere we went was finding a good breakfast or a good market where we could buy some food in a you know, a hostel or a hotel where there was a kitchen. You know, that was essential. And so we ended up lucking out, and we came to this villa, you know, on the coast of the Mediterranean with a nice kitchen, and lo and behold, there was this wonderful farmer's market nearby, and we decided, you know, we found a good spot. Let's stay here for a week. And so we camped out in this villa, and, you know, every morning we'd go and buy some food and cook it up, and, you know, maybe we'd go on hikes, you know, wander on the beach, but I've never really been quite so lazier, you know, if you call cooking lazy, I wouldn't, but, you know.
Did anyone own this villa?
Yeah, I mean, it was just a rental. You know,
nice.
It was like off-season, it was perfect timing, and, you know, we lucked out. And so we ended up staying there long enough to meet a few people, and, you know, there was the owner of a nearby cafe who would talk to us at length about, you know, the connection between his family and different foods, and just kind of starting to absorb a lot of the Italian, you know, culture behind eating. And I think one of the most memorable conversations we had was with this man named Alex, who he ran a agriturismo, a bed and breakfast farm, and he was talking to us about how, you know, dinner didn't begin. You know, dinner doesn't begin when you sit down at a table. It doesn't begin when you start cooking. It begins when you wake up and go to the market. And, you know, the people you meet along the way are going to flavor your meal. And the different products at the market, you know, just seeing them, you might be inspired to change, you know, what you're doing. And, you know, the idea that what you're eating is, you know, a lot to do with your friends and just the process of living in the place where where you eat.
That's a great sentiment. Mm-hmm. And what about you?
It's true.
Megan, do you have one?
I can't think of any specific. I'm sort of food obsessed, so lots of different. I often think that's the best meal I've ever had, but it's
just the
often,
last best
it's,
meal.
Exactly. But I think most of the best food memories for me are when I've eaten outside. I just love
outside as in open air.
Open air.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if it's a cup of coffee on the porch in the morning that we often do, just sitting outside and drinking that cup of coffee makes it taste just so much better, I think. Or having, and it can be as simple as a barbecue in a backyard or sitting at a cafe somewhere or looking over the lake here. It's a beautiful place to be. So,
well, one thing I think really has come through today, you know, in all of our conversations is truly the connection of where you are. And the fact is, we've talked a lot about Vermont today, but we know it's not the only place on the universe. And I think what Chris said earlier about hoping that his tours will inspire people to want to take a feeling like they get here. Like, I'm sure you eat differently now that you have that experience in Italy. Mm-hmm. And you seem to always savor the moment in how you're eating. Mm-hmm. So it's very important. So we've got just a couple minutes left. Any final words on this notion of culinary tourism or, you know, what you might see as the future for the state? What do you think direction we're going? I mean, I know our Agency of Agriculture is very supportive of these efforts and initiatives. Any wishes you'd like to have them hear about?
Yeah, I think, you know, the culinary tourism as an industry is obviously taking off in the United States. And, you know, it's long overdue. It's a pretty thriving, you know, industry in Italy or in most of Europe.
Right.
And so, you know, being a part of it and being one of the, you know, the first companies to be connecting people with food is exciting. And I think what I really hope to turn it into is a means to build, you know, a regional food system. You know, having Vermonters learn a lot about the farmers that produce the food they eat. And then also inspiring visitors to seek out those connections where they're from. And I think that, you know, when you're eating food with a person who made it and the place it comes from, you know, it's just going to create a memory that's, you know, a tremendous marketing experience, and it's, you know, hopefully something that's going to change how you buy food and how you engage the food system. So I think it can, you know, bring about a real change in the American food system and here in Vermont, too.
That's great. One tour at a time.
Yep. And it reduces pollution. I mean, there's so many other reasons to be growing and shopping locally. It makes so much sense. And it's not just in Vermont. It can be happening all over the country, all over the world. So
it's a
good direction. Yep. Start, seek it out wherever you live.
Well, with that note, I want to thank all of you for listening this week.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been a great show. Thank you so much. I welcome your comments and requests, and please send those to Deborah at ediblegreenmountains.com. Let me know if there's a topic or a person you'd like us to feature. I want to thank our sponsor again, Ann Saxelby, and our guest, Chris Howell of Vermont Farm Tours. You can check out his website at vermontfarmtours.com, and Megan Humphrey of Shelburne Orchards, and you can check out their site at shelburneorchards.com. Tune in next Monday for another edition of the Edible Community Show. I'll be back on September 21st with Anna Thomas, author of the newly published Love Soup, Charles Shackleton, creator of the Naked Table Project, and the ever-popular Charlie Nardozzi. So until next time, enjoy.